drinking it because I didn't get coffee. As for Isla, she leaves right after breakfast, which Alice serves her. I don't get a chance to say hello or even gauge her mood. She could have said good morning to me if she wanted. The townhouse is hardly a 50-room mansion, but she did not. That is telling. I'm supposed to clean Gray's bedroom as soon as he leaves for work. That day, though, it is past 10 and his door remains closed. I slip in to find him at his desk, fingers tapping the top. He's obviously deep in thought, and I should take his tray and leave, but I feel like when I was a kid and my parents' moods were off, and I just had to know whether it was because of something I'd done.
May I bring you fresh coffee, sir? This has gone cold.
He waves me off, and I pick up the untouched tray. I'm about to leave when he says, "Is there any jam?"
"Jam, sir?"
"Jam and bread. A tea with honey." I'm not focusing as well as I like, and that is usually the problem.
"Low blood sugar. That'll do it."
He frowns over, and I realize my words won't make sense to him. What catches his ear, I bet, is the word blood.
I say, "I mean that I often find that if I do not eat in the morning, I cannot concentrate as well."
He seems to be half listening. I don't take offense, considering that's twice as much as he's listened to me so far today.
"I will bring bread with lots of jam and tea with lots of honey."
I pause.
"You do seem very busy, sir. If there's anything I could do? Note-taking, perhaps?"
He shakes his head. "I will not pull you from your duties today, Katrina."
"Pull away, please."
The words are on the tip of my tongue. At first, I hold them back because the phrasing is too modern. But that pause gives me time to realize the truth of what he's saying. If I don't do my chores, who does? Mrs. Wallace? Alice? To ask for casework means pushing my maid duties onto the shoulders of others. Damned ethical dilemmas. Let's try another angle.
"I finished the book you allowed me to read, sir. Thank you very much for that."
"Oh?" That catches his attention. "Already?"
"It was very informative. Did you notice Song C mentions looking under fingernails for signs of bamboo splints, indicating torture? I have marked the page if you would like to show it to Detective MacReady. In the meantime, perhaps there is another book I could read on forensic science?"
"You are welcome to any in the library, Katrina." Not quite what I was hoping for, but he really is distracted by whatever he's doing. And the fact that he hasn't shooed me out should prove that Isla hasn't shared her suspicions.
"Thank you, sir. Again, if there's anything I can do, I will ensure I still complete my chores, and do not force anyone else to perform them."
He hesitates, and my breath catches. He runs his hand over his chin, dark with stubble. "I do not suppose you have remembered how to shave?" As my hopes plummet, my brain spins. Could I manage it? That would make him happy and give us time to talk. Give me time to prove I'm genuinely interested in his studies, and would make an excellent replacement for James, the lost assistant. Except, I have no idea how to use a straight razor, and might slit his throat. Damned ethical dilemmas. He rubs at his stubble, and I can't help noticing the strong line of his jaw, the curve of his lips, his ink-dappled fingers. The letter. I have done so well forgetting that damned letter, and I really don't need it creeping back now. Yes, Gray's a good-looking guy. Yes, he's an interesting guy. But he's my boss, and hell no. Scrub that letter from my brain, please.
Katrina?
I wrench my gaze away and manage a shallow curtsy.
Apologies, sir. I was thinking of how much I hate to refuse such a simple request, but I do fear that if I wield a razor, we may end up with an unexpected display of blood spatter to study.
His laugh is so unexpected that I jump a little.
I understand, he says. If you do recall how to use a razor, though, I would appreciate it. While I have no interest in expanding the household, That is the one downfall to a lack of male indoor staff.
I'll try to recall the skill, sir.
Please do. Oh, and speaking of male staff, Simon is gathering the day's papers for me. Please bring them to me immediately. I am most interested in what the press has to say regarding our killer.
Our killer?
That's promising.
Might I read them after you, sir? I am also interested.
Of course, he says. And he returns to contemplating the mysteries of the blank wall before I'm even out the door.
Chapter 15.
I'm dusting in the drawing room when boots clomp in the hall. I've come to dread that sound, because it means someone just came in from outdoors and they're tracking mud across my clean floors. I can't just say, screw it, I already washed those. Nope, I need to grab a bucket and re-mop before Mrs. Wallace spots dirt. All of this could be solved if they'd take off their damned boots or shoes at the door, like a proper Canadian. I remember the first time we visited American friends, and I realized they don't even switch to indoor shoes. What kind of heathens traipse through the house in the same shoes they just wore outside, through mud and dog dirt and God knows what else? At least I must credit the average non-Canadian with having the sense to remove obviously dirty footwear. Not so in Victorian Scotland, where guys walk in from tromping along a horseshit-laden road and track it all on my clean floors. Why? Because I'm here. I exist to clean it up.
So, they were not telling tales,
a male voice says in a thick country brogue.
You really did rise from the dead.
I turn to see a young man. He's in his late teens, with a mop of dark brown hair, sharp features, and a grin that lights up blue-gray eyes.
Not even going to say hello, Cat?
He asks.
I suppose it takes more than a bump on the head to forget you're angry with me.
That's when I notice the stack of newspapers in his hand. Simon, I say, and try not to add a question mark.
Well, I ought to be glad you didn't forget my name.
He walks into the drawing room and slaps the stack of papers on a side table.
These are for Dr. Gray. See, he gets them as quick as you can. And,
he casts a glance around and then lowers his voice.
I know you are displeased with me, Kat, and I wish it were otherwise.
I miss your conversation. His grin sparks, and I try not to inch back. Dear Lord, Katrina. How many boys were you dangling on your bonnet strings? Simon sobers.
Yeah, as much as I miss you, Kat, I won't be changing my mind. Colin Findlay is a good man, and I'll not have you doing him wrong for a bit of fun and a few bob.
Police Constable Findlay? His brows rise.
You know another?
No, just... I clear my throat.
Remind me why we are at odds? Over Constable Findlay?
He arches one brow, and I tap my temple.
My memory, remember?
We are at odds, as you put it, because the poor man is besotted, and you bat your eyes at him so he'll court you with pretty trinkets and baubles that you sell as quick as you can. It isn't right.
Would it be more right if I gave him something in return for those trinkets and baubles?
Simon's face turns serious again as he meets my eye.
In truth, it would, Cap. At least then it would be an honest exchange. 'Tis a poor trick to play on a man who does not deserve it, and I'll not change my mind on that. If you want to come visit me in the stables, you cannot be leading him on anymore.
I stop myself before saying I'm no longer leading Findlay on. True, but nor do I want to be visiting Simon in the stables. Then I rewind our conversation and pause.
You said I sell whatever gifts he gives me.
Do not pretend otherwise, Kat. You bragged about it a fortnight ago.
Yes, but where do I sell them?
He frowns. At a pawn shop?
Do you know which one? Have I ever said?
No. Why?
He gives a short laugh.
Ah. Having lost some of your memories, you forgot where to pawn your pretties. I cannot help you there.
Cannot? Or will not?
Both.
He slaps the stack of papers. Take these up to Dr. Gray, and leave poor Findlay be.
I nod, and he shakes his head and tromps out, leaving dirt in his wake.
Okay, so I'm starting to get a picture of Katrina's love life. She seems to be casually involved with Simon. I suspect their relationship was more chaste than the 21st century version of Friends with Benefits. Oh, I'm sure there was plenty of sex happening between unmarried teens. But I'm also sure we predate reliable birth control, and Simon's smiles felt more flirtatious than lascivious. Meanwhile, she's been flirting with Constable Findlay, who's showering her with gifts when she has no intention of doing more than batting her eyelashes at him. Or does she? Could Katrina have had plans that she didn't share with Simon? Did she intend to win the young officer as a husband? That would be a step up, wouldn't it? From the way MacReady dresses, detectives make a decent wage. Not exorbitant. He's unmarried with no obvious dependents, and so he can afford to spend a little extra on his tailoring bill. In the same way I could afford a condo, albeit a tiny one, in Canada's most expensive city. Katrina accepts Findlay's wooing gifts, and accepts his wooing, while playing the shy maiden who won't do more than hold his hand before the wedding day. She certainly isn't going to tell Simon that. They might be casual, but no guy wants to hear that a girl is only with him while she makes a play for someone else. What happened between Katrina and Findlay? Something, for sure, considering the cold shoulder he's giving her. Did she tell him to put a ring on it and he backed off, not being in the market for a wife? Or did he make a pass that she rebuffed? None of this should matter. I'm not Katrina, and I have no interest in either young man, both being roughly two-thirds my age. It's like watching a soap opera romance. Except the friends with benefits is a co-worker, and the suitor without benefits is MacReady's assistant, which means I can't avoid either guy. I'll need to keep both at arm's length, which shouldn't be difficult, considering they're both unhappy with Miss Katrina. I resist the urge to read the papers before I run them upstairs to Gray. There are several newspapers, plus a few single flyers and pamphlets, that I mistake for advertising until I see they're about Archie Evans's murder. Huh. I skim one flyer as I climb the stairs. It's a large single sheet that details the crime from the report of an intimate observer. According to the sheet, Evans had been brutally murdered, his limbs gruesomely fashioned into a bird's wings and limbs, in a manner this writer dares not describe, so great the horror. They'd been tied in place? The story has been poorly printed on cheap paper. There's a byline, though, one that proclaims the author Edinburgh's foremost reporter of criminal activities. The other sheet is a similarly fictionalized account of the murder. It's as if I said to the writers, "Hey, some guy was murdered and made to look like a bird," and their imaginations filled in the rest. Imaginations that produced a picture far bloodier and more lurid than the actual murder. I'm reading through the second account when Gray's door opens. I'm standing there, sheet in one hand, the other raised for a knock that I have yet to give.
"I believe those are mine," Gray says.
Yes. Apologies, sir. He waves me inside.
"Put them on my desk, please, Katrina. You may keep that one and finish reading it, if you like. I presume you would like that."
His lips twitch in a way that rankles a little. It's kind, but indulgent, too, as if I'm a child. Then I catch a glimpse of myself in his mirror and see a teenager who looks like a milkmaid, all rosy pink cheeks and honey blonde curls and cream-fed curves. In this world, there are two options for a man of 30 with a 19-year-old female assistant. Either I'm a delectable morsel, his for the taking, or I'm a clever girl he's encouraging to explore higher educational interests.
Gray is thankfully embracing option two. He's treating me like a child, because to him, that's what I am. I half curtsy.
That is most kind, sir. I'll read it and be out of your way.
He waves a distracted hand at a chair. There are quite enough papers here to keep us from quarreling over them. I would appreciate your thoughts as you read.
I straighten a little at that. Thank you, sir.
I dare say you shall bring a very different lens to the reading, one untainted by expertise in these matters. I bite my tongue. Bite it so damned hard. Instead, I lower my lashes.
Of course, sir. I am flattered that you think a housemaid could have anything to add.
Everyone has something to add, Katrina. Do not discount yourself like that. With enough learning, you could be a proper little detective. You seem to have some talent for it.
So kind of you to say so, sir.
Reading those damn papers is an exercise in restraint. In restraining myself from dissecting the accounts of the crime and giving a commentary that will leave Gray gaping. I am an observer in this world. I cannot risk raising the suspicions of the one person who does not suspect me of anything untoward. I can make the occasional observation, such as noting that Evans had been tortured, but I cannot overdo it. In truth, as much as I want to show off, I'm not sure I could. There's nothing in these accounts we don't already know. Well, nothing of truth. Even the newspapers are rife with fabrications. One journalist, who claims to have known Evans personally, says he was an unusually handsome young man with curly hair and the smooth face of an angel. The guy on Gray's examination table had been bearded with straight hair.
They're making it up, I say. Even the newspapers.
Of course.
But why? There was a press conference. I hardly saw anyone there.
Gray shrugs, his eyes still scanning an article. Why bother attending that when they can invent something more entertaining? They are wordsmiths, crafting a narrative to suit their audience.
And these?
I lift one of the single pages.
These are pure fiction.
Yes, and probably written by the newspaper men under a nom de plume. They could not get away with that level of insinuation and lurid detail in the regular press. He glances over his newspaper at me. I know broadsides are going out of fashion, but I am surprised you have never read one.
Why would anyone read them?
Presumably for the reason they are written. Entertainment. Crime is a profitable business. My sister has, more than once, threatened to turn my cases into novels to make her fortune. I think she was joking, but I am not actually sure. I flip through the pile of newspapers, along with the two broadsides, plus two pamphlets that go into slightly more, equally fictional detail.
The case is getting a lot of attention.
He tilts his head. I presume you speak in jest.
This isn't a lot?
He gives a low laugh and then rubs away his smile. I do not mean to mock. You obviously fail to share the public's fascination with murder. And so this might seem like a great deal of attention. It is the opposite, in fact.
Why? It's a strikingly singular murder.
Too singular. And in entirely the wrong way.
Explain?
I cough.
I mean, please explain your thinking, sir, if you would.
It is singular in its staging. As an intellectual exercise, poor Evans's death is fascinating. What person conceives of such a thing? I am no alienist, but even I must wonder at such a mind. It is almost, dare I say, artistic.
The killer has a vision. Or else he is plagued by inner demons, and this is his way of expressing it, a compulsion.
Gray's eyes light up, and I feel like a student giving a perfect answer. Quite right. That makes the murder and the killer remarkably interesting to me, and apparently also to you. However, to the average citizen, Evans's murder lacks passion. It is a cerebral killing, and therefore quite dull. Nary a severed limb to be found. They're bloodless crimes, and as such... I feign a yawn, and that has his face lighting up in a way that makes my heart stutter. Gray leans forward, warming to his subject. They are boring. That is why we have this. He lifts one of the broadsides. Writers doing their best to work with what little they have.
What are people looking for? I ask.
Blood and gore? That is the question, Katrina, and one you ought to discuss with my sister, who is fascinated by which crimes do or do not catch the public's attention. As soon as one thinks one has the answer, there is an exception. Blood and gore, as you put it, certainly sells papers and broadsides. Yet you will also find such cases knocked clean off the front page by a man falling from a ladder and dying of internal injuries.
Because there's more story to the man on the ladder? He was about to marry or have his first child or such?
Pathos, yes, that certainly plays a role. Violent and pathetic deaths. An innocent babe murdered alongside her sweet mother. A promising young man, his head bashed, bits of brain on the ceiling. An elderly woman, throat slit as she awaits the first visit from her great-grandchild. Yet again, Isla could show examples of the most tragic situations that barely rippled the public's attention. Also, one must account for competing events. I was following one particularly fascinating case myself 4 years ago when it disappeared from the press, swallowed by a foreign murder. He waits, as if to see whether I'll figure it out. The shooting of an American president.
Lincoln?
His lips twitch. You truly do not follow the news, do you? Yes, the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. That month, the most horrific deaths would not have made the front page. Then there is the issue of urbanization. He cuts himself short and pulls back with the faintest smile. I will spare you that particular lecture.
No, please, go on.
I meet his gaze.
I am interested.
Briefly, or we shall be here all day. While murder is hardly a new invention, it became far more commonplace in the city, where one might hope to escape justice in the way one could not in the country, where everyone knows everyone else's business. Yes, in the city we are more anonymous. Some might also say that population density breeds apathy. Too many people to care about. When you look back at murder 50 years ago, each one was a public sensation. The appetite for details was insatiable. People could eat for months telling the story of how they once dined with the killer in a public house. If the victim died in a barn, that barn could be dismantled and sold for a king's ransom, everyone wanting a piece. But as cities grew and murders multiplied, people became jaded.
They need stories that strike an emotional chord, whether it be horror or sympathy. The murder of Archie Evans is passionless and bloodless. It is getting some attention because it is odd, but it will not inspire penny dreadfuls.
He sets down his paper. There is nothing in these. I feared as much, but I wish to be thorough. My task, our task, is to find clues that will help Detective MacReady, and if I am fortunate, some of those clues will also prove useful for my studies. He checks his pocket watch. Speaking of Hugh, he is due for lunch to discuss the case, and if you'd be so kind as to serve the meal, you may join us and listen in.
And as a special treat, little Katrina, you may join us after you've waited on us hand and foot.
Yes, once again, my back went up at that. But Gray isn't a senior officer expecting a female detective to serve the coffee and donuts at a staff meeting. He's a guy expecting his employee to do her job,
while he also encourages her outside interests. I've been part of only a few sting operations, and I find myself wishing I'd had more undercover experience to slide into this headspace. I am Katrina. I am a housemaid. I was hired to serve Gray's meals, and I'm damn lucky he's letting me join their lunchtime conversation. He doesn't make me sit in the corner with my servant's lunch, either. I am given a seat at the table and expected to fully share in their more sumptuous meal. I don't miss Alice's shocked face when she pops her head in, and I hate to even think what Mrs. Wallace will say. As for the lunch conversation, while Gray might say his only interest in the case is forensic, that's obviously not true. Nor does MacReady treat him like a crime scene tech. Lacking a detective partner, MacReady bounces ideas and theories off his old friend. I also get the impression Gray isn't the only one who helps. When MacReady walks in to lunch, his first question is, "Where's Isla?" And when Gray says she is away, MacReady can't hide his disappointment. The two men discuss the case. Isla has analyzed the water and believes it is from a tap. It's definitely fresh water rather than salt, and the lack of foreign particles suggests it's not from a body of standing water, like a puddle. They still aren't sure what that means. My waterboarding hypothesis has obviously been dismissed. Next, MacReady brings Gray up to speed on the day's work. They've canvassed people living near the park where Evans was found. One person reported seeing a masked man in a black cape. Then there's the guy who insists he saw a huge raven land and grow to human form. "The young man Evans was living with still refused to speak to me," MacReady says. "I am apparently the enemy." He rolls his eyes. "It's a household of young radicals, all convinced the police only exist to deprive them of their rights." "Kids these days," I mutter. Too low for them to make out the words, but MacReady glances over at the sound of my voice. "You agree with them, Katrina?" "I agree that some people have sound reasons to fear the police. Not only those who engage in criminal activity, but those who have been unjustly persecuted in the past. There are bullies in any organization, but police do have the ability to ruin a life, and some do." "Perhaps. But to tarnish me with that brush is unwarranted." I shrug. "Uncomfortable, more than unwarranted. They don't know you, but you don't know their situation and their experiences with the law. If they are radicals, those experiences have likely been negative. Police are the enemy of protesters because they are often seen as enemy by police." "It sounds as if you have some experience with this." "I have never been what you would call a radical. I know some who are, though. Getting them to speak to you is going to take time you can ill afford when you only wish to question them. I would suggest you send in someone they will speak to. Perhaps me." Gray frowns.
"Why would they speak to you?" He pauses. "Ah, yes. You alluded to knowing radicals."
MacReady gives him a look. "They will speak to her because she's a fetching young lady, and they are a household of rowdy young men. That would be obvious to anyone but you, Duncan."
"No," Gray says coolly. "I did not mention it because it might suggest we expect her to employ her feminine charms."
"I'm fine with flirting," I say. "Help me come up with a cover story and tell me what you want to know." Chapter 16. That afternoon, I'm taking on my first Victorian undercover mission. I'm shocked by how readily MacReady agreed. Yet more proof that policing is very different in this world. He didn't need to clear it with a supervisor. He doesn't need me to sign a waiver. He barely even hesitated when I suggested it. He's putting a lot of trust in a layperson. He can't even mic me to get a recording of the interview for court. Of course, I must remember that Scotland has only had an established police force for about 50 years.
This is still the Wild West of policing, and I should be impressed they're as far along as they are, with criminal officers and homicide investigations. Gray doesn't try to stop me either. He only makes sure I'm comfortable with the situation. He lets me know I can back out at any time, and that if it goes wrong, no one will hold it against me. He does, however, insist on accompanying us, though I suspect at least part of that is just for the excuse to escape his armchair investigator role and get into the field. MacReady will join us in the old town with Constable Findlay. Gray needs to attend to a client first, and by the time he's finished, we're running late, so he decides to take the coach. As I climb in, I look around the interior. It's all black, down to the painted metal trim.
"Is this a hearse?" I say.
Gray gives me a look as he settles in on the seat opposite.
"Do you see a place for a coffin, Katrina?"
"It could convert to one. Lay down a few boards to transport the dearly departed, and then flip up the seats for daily use."
"Somehow I do not think my guests would appreciate traveling in anything used to convey the dead." I shrug.
"Wouldn't bother me."
"The smell might."
I have to laugh at that. True enough, if bodies aren't being embalmed yet. He settles into his seat.
"As for the coach, yes, you will have noticed it is rather austere. It's used in funeral processions. The hearse, which I am certain you've seen, has glass sides to display the coffin. This one is used for the chief mourners, but it is expedient to also use it personally, as it is of a much higher quality than I'd otherwise purchase."
I watch out the window as we go, and as much as I enjoy a pleasant walk, I'm glad to be in the coach today. Scotland has a reputation for overcast, drizzly weather, but in Edinburgh you get the wind thrown in for free. And today it's wicked, driving that drizzle in my face and making me feel like I'm back in Vancouver in November. I try not to think of what it's like at home right now. Sunny and warm, the beaches starting to fill. Still, while I might not love Edinburgh's weather, the city itself makes up for it. With its gorgeously vibrant gardens and green spaces, alongside soot-stained medieval buildings. When we arrive in the proper neighborhood, MacReady and Gray decide they're going to hole up in a pub with a nice hot toddy. And who will escort me closer to the radical's lair? That would be Constable Findlay, the guy who's been doing his best to pretend I don't exist. Wonderful. We leave Gray and MacReady at their toasty warm pub, and we continue on foot to Evans's lodgings. Simon has taken the coach home. I can't exactly pull up to the rooming house in a gleaming black coach. We must walk. And walk in silence, it seems. I get two blocks before I turn to Findlay. Time to get this over with.
"I know I have done something to upset you," I say. "The blow to my head means that I do not remember what it is. I must ask you to tell me so I might apologize."
"I do not wish to discuss it."
He pulls his cap down over his ears and marches on against the wind. He's in his civvies, and without his uniform, he looks less like a scrub-cheeked cadet and more like a regular guy. A kid, even, no older than Katrina herself. I should drop this. The last thing I want is this young man trying to rekindle our relationship. Yet, if I'm going to help Gray with the case, then I need to calm these waters with Findlay.
"Whatever it is, please know that I am sorry for what I have done. I was not a good person, and it took a brush with death for me to realize that. I have hurt people, including you, and I am sorry."
He only grunts.
"I just wish to say..."
"You aren't going to let this drop, are you?" "Fine. I am not hurt, Katrina. I am disappointed. That is all. Detective MacReady tried to warn me about your past, and I told him he was mistaken."
"And he was not,"
I say softly. "There. We have said all we need to say on the matter."
"I am sorry. Truly sorry.
You made a fool of me," he snaps. "I could have lost my position. You know how hard I worked for it."
"You could have lost your position because...
He hunkers down against the drizzle and picks up his pace.
I believed you when you said you were interested in my work.
You only wanted information you could pass on to your friends.
God damn it, Katrina.
Just when I think you couldn't stoop any lower, you need to prove me wrong, contrary wench that you are.
So, that's why she flirted with Finley. Not for his trinkets, not for the hope of a wedding band, for information she could sell.
Wait. How angry was he? Angry enough to ambush her in an alley? I say, carefully,
I am sorry to push this. I truly have lost my memories. That attack.
I shiver.
It was nearly the end of me.
As I speak, I watch his face for even a flicker of guilt. Nothing passes behind his eyes except a spark of hard anger.
Yes, he says. It was.
When I heard you had been hurt, I silently vowed that I would bring your attacker to justice myself. I started asking questions, poking about the grass market, and what do I hear? How you were selling my information the very night you were attacked.
So, Finley didn't know about Katrina's betrayal until after the attack. No wonder he's so angry.
He strode in, determined to bring her assailant to justice, only to discover his sweet maiden had betrayed him. That she had been in the act of betraying him when she was assaulted. Katrina had been attacked while selling police information. That's a solid clue. I know she was in a black market pub. Now I know why.
You have nothing to say to that, do you? Finley says.
I am not certain how to respond beyond apologizing with all sincerity. I have wronged many people, including you. I am sorry.
I meet his gaze.
Very, truly sorry.
He glances away and says abruptly, "Let's get this over with." The address leads to a townhouse, sandwiched into a row of them. Several have room to let signs. This one has a sign in the window politely declaring it Mrs. Trowbridge's rooming house for young gentlemen. When MacReady said Archie Evans lived in a house with other young men, I pictured the modern arrangement, where a bunch of guys rent a place together, which is silly in Victorian times. If there isn't a woman in residence, they'll starve to death, dying in a bed that hasn't had its sheets changed in a year. Okay, yes, I'm sure there are self-sufficient Victorian bachelors, but I suspect far too many would be like Gray, setting the kitchen aflame when he tries to make coffee. Someone has always done that for them. The solution, naturally, is a boarding house, where the proprietress may bridge that inconvenient gap between leaving mommy and snagging a wife. I climb the steps, and before I knock, I open the box in my arms to reveal the meat pies within. Then I rap smartly and wait. When no one answers, I rap again. There's a male shout, a period-appropriate version of "someone answer the damn door." Boots clomp, and the door flies open to reveal a young man a year or two younger than Katrina. He's dressed in rumpled clothing with no necktie, which in this world is like answering the door shirtless. He looks from me to the pies and back again. Then he smirks.
"Did someone order a tart?"
he shouts into the house.
"Excuse me?"
I say. He blinks.
"Did you just call me a tart?"
I say. His mouth works and his gaze flies to the pies.
"I meant the pastries."
"Of course you did."
Another young man appears behind the first and slaps him on the shoulder.
"Ignore this lout. He's already nipping the brandy. I'm Henry, by the way."
This young man wears a tie and looks moderately less rumpled. There's still a glitter in his eyes that I know well. He's seen an opening, positioning himself as my savior, and I'm supposed to swoon in appreciation.
"I heard the news about Archie," I say. "I wanted to say how sorry I am. May I step in? Presuming Mrs. Trowbridge is at home and would find it
appropriate.
She's here somewhere. Henry winks. She tends to hide when we're home from classes.
He ushers me through a dreary hallway and waves toward an open doorway. Through it, half a dozen young men lounge about. Two are arm wrestling, while another two egg them on and share a bottle. A fifth is stretched out on the floor with a textbook, and the guy who answered the door has gone back to reading something that is definitely not a textbook, given the cover art of a very buxom lady in her underthings. It's a Victorian frat house. When I walk in, all six turn to look at me. All six mentally undress me, and the one reading the porn doesn't even bother to hide the cover. In fact, he lifts it to make sure I see it. Yep, definitely a frat house.
Well, well, what have we here? Says one of the drinkers, getting unsteadily to his feet. Did Thomas say something about tarts?
Please tell me your wares are for sale, miss.
Cheap, I hope. I am a poor student after all.
Henry raises a hand. None of that. The young woman is here to pay her respects. She has brought us pies.
I half curtsy.
I am so sorry to hear of Archie's passing. I know you are all in mourning, but I did wish to bring these pies. I step farther into the room, arranging my features in the appropriate look of sorrow. I cannot believe he is gone, and in such a grisly fashion.
One of the lounging boys snorts. He was strangled.
You do not think it terribly macabre? Staged to look like a bird.
Macabre? A loud laugh from Thomas, the guy who'd answered the door. Look at the big words coming from that pretty mouth. Where did you learn that one? On the back of a penny dreadful.
It is macabre, says the one who is actually studying.
She chooses her words well. I fear we are dealing with a madman. I hear one escaped from the asylum.
I presume he's mocking me, but his face is somber, and two of his roommates nod.
Perhaps, I say. And yet,
I bite my lip.
I ought not to say this, but I am devilishly curious.
Thomas waggles his brows.
Devilishly curious, are you now?
I focus on the young man with the textbook. His ogle had been perfunctory, like an obligation he had to fulfill, and thus got out of the way as quickly as possible.
I have heard, I begin.
They all lean in to listen. My target shuts his textbook.
Heard what, miss?
The rumor is that poor Archie was tortured. It was not a random murder. His killer wanted something from him.
I pause for effect.
Information.
There's an audible shift in the room, and a palpable one in the air. Thomas rises from his seat and steps toward me.
Is that what you heard? He says.
From his tone, I'm supposed to step back. To drop my gaze, to stammer that perhaps I am mistaken. Instead, I laser focus on him, that shift in the air telling me I've stumbled into more than a Victorian frat house. MacReady did call them radicals, even if I've seen no sign of that.
That is the rumor, I say, though I can't imagine what anyone would want from poor Archie. I do know he wrote about local crime for the Edinburgh Evening Courant. I can only guess some ruffian thought he knew too much and killed him for it.
The young men exchange a look.
That must be it, Henry says smoothly. We always told Archie he needed to be more careful in such a dangerous line of work. He had quite the habit of talking when he ought to hold his tongue.
I bet he did. I gaze around the room, as if I have not only lost track of what he was saying, but lost interest, too. Ideas, they are so difficult for my female brain. As I search the room, I spot something near the settee. A crate filled with folded papers, like the crime pamphlets Simon brought for Gray. There's a hideously ugly embroidered pillow right next to the box, and that's what I pretend to focus on. I wander over to the pillow and touch it, murmuring that it's such a pretty design. Meanwhile, I sneak a look at the pamphlets in that box. Then I blink, trying to hide my surprise. MacReady called these boys radicals. He also said they hate the police, and so I presumed that meant left-leaning student activists. But what I see in this box is something all too familiar. A month before I left for Edinburgh, I'd been working a hate crime case, and I'd helped conduct a search on one of the suspect's apartments. On his hard drive, I found a massive trove of memes for redistribution. Indescribably ugly hate. The sort that if I showed it to some of my friends, they'd swear it wasn't real. That it belonged in another century because no one thought like that these days. What I see in that box is the Victorian equivalent. Pamphlets screaming about the foreign menace invading proud Scottish lands. I jerk my head up before anyone notices where my attention had gone, and I turn toward the young men. My expression is blank. That's a skill I learned on my first case dealing with white supremacists. Don't let them see how disgusted you are. Not unless it'll serve your purpose. It won't, here. I adjust my grip on the pie box.
Yes. I fear poor Archie did always talk too much, and it has doubtless been the death of him. I wonder, though,
a string of curses has me turning to see Thomas peering out the front window.
There's a police constable out there.
What? Henry strides over to look. He adds to the curses.
Does he think we will not recognize him without his uniform? It's a wonder we didn't smell the stench from here.
I stroll over until I can see Findlay across the street. Yes, he's not in uniform, but his bearing gives him away. Spine ramrod straight, gaze scanning the street as if he's on patrol.
That lad is a police constable, I say. He looks terribly young.
Thomas wheels, advancing on me so fast that I do step back this time.
You brought him here.
What?
We should have seen it straight away. Just look at her yellow hair.
He grabs a lock before I can get out of reach.
She's German. Maybe Russian.
Thomas sneers.
Russian, I wager.
Do I sound Russian?
I see the slap coming. His expression telegraphs it, but my brain still doesn't react fast enough. It would, in the modern day. But this is Victorian times, and I am a fair maiden on a condolence call. Surely he will not strike me. He does exactly that. Or he tries, because while I may inwardly curse my delay, I still manage to duck the slap. He doesn't expect that, and his face goes bright red. And when he spins on me, it's not a mere slap, he telegraphs. It's a right hook. With no room to escape, I block instead, my arm flying up to stop his, the pies falling to the floor as someone gasps. I think they're gasping because this guy is attacking me, or maybe even because I dropped the damn pies. But then I see faces turned my way, the shock on them, and I catch a glimpse of myself reflected in a glass cabinet door, and I see me, Mallory. Oh, it's Katrina's body, but the expression is my own, a cold rage that stuns everyone except the guy attacking me. Thomas sees that look, and he sees me blocking his blow, and he tries to stomach punch me. I almost make the mistake of kicking him away. A mistake because I'm wearing 4 layers of skirts. My knee rises, and it registers the confining fabric just in time. I grab and twist his arm instead, spinning him around. Then I shove him. He smacks into a dainty side table, toppling it with a crash. A door flies open, and a white-haired woman appears. While Henry might have made a snide crack about Mrs. Trowbridge hiding, when she barrels through that door, Thomas scrambles up, brushing off his shirt front. I rush toward her, my eyes wide with feigned terror.
She puts up a hand to stop me, and then sets her hands on her hips.
What's this all about, lass?
I pushed him into the table, ma'am. I am so terribly sorry. I came to pay my respects for poor Archie. This young man accused me of being a foreigner and tried to slap me, and I dropped the pies, and then he tried to hit me again, so I pushed him.
Foreigner,
she says, as if this is the most important part of my recitation. She glares at Thomas.
Are you daft? How does this poor lass look like a foreigner?
His mouth works, nothing coming out.
Even if she were, which she is not, there is no call to slap her. I won't have that nonsense in my house. You will apologize and you will pay her for the pies.
Pay her? He squeaks.
Apologize and pay her double for the pies, or you can pack your bags and go.
The lass came to pay her respects, which is more than any of you have done.
Poor Archie has been murdered, and you carry on as if nothing happened. When the school term is done, I want the lot of you gone.
There's satisfaction in her voice, as if she's wanted them gone for a while and is happy for an excuse. They haven't seemed too torn up over Evans, and her words prove they aren't. Together with Thomas's comments about Evans not knowing when to keep his mouth shut, I have a reasonable theory about why Evans was tortured. Someone identified him as the weak link in this group, the one most likely to talk. I'm not getting anything else from Evans's roommates. Mrs. Trowbridge might be another matter. For now, she's a potential asset to stick in my back pocket. Thomas's apology is half-assed. He does pay, though, and I try to give the coins to Mrs. Trowbridge for the table. That wins me brownie points I can use later, as her gaze softens and she pats my hand and tells me I'm a good girl. But no, the young lads will pay for the table. By the time she escorts me to the door, Findlay has made himself scarce. I thank Mrs. Trowbridge and head out into the street to go find him. Chapter 17. For my efforts, I am rewarded with a piping hot drink. Not a hot toddy, sadly. Okay, I don't actually know what's in a hot toddy, but it always sounds delightful. Katrina doesn't get that. She doesn't even get a toasty little pub to warm her bones. She gets a formal tea room, which is supposed to be a treat, but damn it, I want my boozy drink and roaring fire. Also, may I point out that the person who most enjoys my treat is the one who suggests it? Gray is practically vibrating as he surveys the pastries in the window. Ignoring the tiny sandwiches and currant-studded scones on our tray, he goes straight for his cakes and tarts and then starts eyeing everyone else's. Findlay hands his over quickly, as if Gray's sidelong look is an order from on high. MacReady sighs and gives him one of his tarts. I pretend not to notice Gray eyeing the putty four that MacReady bought me separately in appreciation of my fine efforts. Those are mine, damn it, and I'm eating every crumb if I need to choke them down. As for the investigation, it seems when MacReady called the young men radicals, it wasn't because he misunderstood the nature of their campaign. To him, a radical is anyone trying to cause trouble, for both worthy and despicable causes. The positive ones fight for things like sanitation. The negative ones fight against things like immigration. I fully support immigration, Findlay says, his first words since we sat down. It broadens and strengthens our country.
I agree that it does, Gray murmurs. Though I have no idea why you are looking at me as you say that.
The poor young man's gaze drops.
I didn't mean... That is to say, if I implied anything, it was not intended as an insult. You are a man of means, both educated and respected.
Best quit while you can, lad, MacReady says. Dr. Gray is as Scottish as I am.
He was born here.
Whatever these young men believe, I say, the important thing is whether it is connected to the murder.
How could it not be? MacReady says. If the young man was tortured, and I'm beginning to believe Duncan was right about that, then it must be connected to the murder. That is the information he had. Something to do with these radicals.
Does that explain the bird staging, though? Gray says.
Are we to presume it is what detective novels call a false clue? Something to distract us from the killer's true intent?
Stool pigeon, Findlay murmurs. MacReady looks up, raised teacup in hand. Gray glances over. Findlay lowers his gaze again.
I could be mistaken, sir, but I thought perhaps the pigeon could signify a stool pigeon. An informer.
MacReady smiles.
That is brilliant, my boy. Excellent insight.
Thank you, sir.
Gray nods.
Hugh is right. That is an excellent theory. If that were the case...
The discussion continues.
I cut one of my petit fours in two and pass half to Gray, who lights up so much I have to smile. Then I settle in to join the conversation, feeling happy and at home for the first time since I arrived. I spend the rest of the day catching up on my chores, working straight through dinner and into the evening. Alice tries to help me refill the coal. I tell her no. Mrs. Wallace says the silver doesn't need to be polished yet. I insisted on doing it. This is my job, and I will show I can do it while helping Dr. Gray. At least until I've proven myself enough for Isla to decide her brother needs me more than Mrs. Wallace does. What really drives me that evening is Isla herself. Oh, she isn't watching me, isn't judging me. She's not even home. And that's the problem. She's been gone all day, and I sense trouble. Mrs. Wallace expected her back for dinner, and Isla sent a note that she was dining out, which seemed to surprise Mrs. Wallace. When the door opens after 8, I tense, every muscle held tight as I will Isla to continue on upstairs for the night. Instead, her footsteps tap into the dining room where I'm polishing the silver.
Katrina?
I turn to see her in the doorway.
I'd like to speak with you in the library, please, she says. You may put away your polishing cloth. You are done for the evening.
I reluctantly return the cloth to its place and try not to trudge into the library like a prisoner awaiting sentencing.
Close the door, please, Katrina.
I do, and when I turn, I find her seated behind the desk, the huge wooden barrier between us. I eye an overstuffed armchair that I've dreamed of curling up in with a book. I look at it now, tear my gaze away, and take a hard-backed chair near the desk.
Have you had any luck locating my locket, Katrina?
Inwardly, I wince. Outwardly, I look as mournful as I can.
No, ma'am, I have not. But I have scarce had time to search. I was thinking it may have fallen... Let us abandon the charade, where we both pretend to have no idea what happened to my locket, where we pretend you have been a saint since Detective MacReady brought you to me. I did not expect sainthood, Katrina. I fancy myself more worldly wise than the charitable matron who gives a halfpenny to a beggar child and is shocked to find her pockets picked. My birth placed me 3 rungs up from you on the ladder of life. I am reaching down to give you the boost denied by fate. That is all.
She folds her hands on the desk.
I did not expect you to immediately abandon your old ways. It was half a year before Alice stopped picking the pockets of our guests. I did not scold her. I simply gave her the support she required to finally accept that her life here was secure, that she would not soon need those pennies to survive.
Isla rubs a hand over her face.
Now I sound exactly like those I seek to rise above, the matron so smug about her goodness and charity. I am tired, Katrina, and I am frustrated.
and I am trying to explain something that you already ought to know, because you are not a 10-year-old child. I know you have stolen from me. I know Mrs. Wallace has caught you and not told me. Little goes on in this house, of which I am not aware. My point is that I know you stole my locket, and I will no longer dance around the accusation. You have it, and I want it back. It is not like the pennies Alice stole, easily replaced. Return it, and we shall speak no more on the matter.
I take a deep breath.
I do not doubt that I stole it, ma'am, and I have upturned my room searching for it. I do hope to find it, only I cannot remember that I took it and where I put it.
On account of your head?
Yes, ma'am. My memory is worse than I have been letting on for fear of losing my position, but I do not feel right hiding it from you.
Your memory is damaged, and yet you clearly remember how to speak, even better than before. Your vocabulary is much expanded, your diction is higher, and you have suddenly remembered your ability to read and write. It is almost as if that blow to the head improved your memory rather than damaging it.
I realize that may seem odd, I say, but I suspect it's not that I've suddenly remembered manners or vocabulary. Rather, I have forgotten that I am supposed to be playing a role. Clearly, my life before this was such that I learned to hide my upbringing and education for fear of seeming to act above my station.
Which you continued with me, lest I think you were putting on airs, knowing how to read and write.
I remember saying something like this to Gray, and his obvious confusion. That makes much more sense now that I've met Isla. Also, now that I've realized that when Alice disappears for half the afternoon, she's doing lesson work. I've seen Mrs. Wallace reading, and I suspect Simon reads too.
I have long suspected you may have lied about your ability to read and write, Katrina. This is Scotland, after all. Your excuse always seemed exactly that.
Okay. So maybe it's not just this household where a servant would know how to read and write. Was Katrina truly an exception? Or did she lie? I clear my throat.
I no longer remember why I chose to hide it. I must have thought there was some advantage to pretending. As Dr. Gray has pointed out, my handwriting is atrocious. And if you ask me to pen letters for you as a lady's maid might do,
I trail off, realizing my excuse is getting even more ridiculous by the word.
I do not know my reasoning,
I say finally.
You only know that you barely remember your old self and feel like an entirely different person because of the injury to your head.
Yes, that is it exactly. She folds her hands on the desk.
Do you know where I have been today, Katrina? Consulting with experts in the field of neurological science. My brother may be the medical doctor, but the brain does not interest him.
Well, not unless it is splattered around a dead body. He has doubtless read some journal article on personality changes due to brain trauma, and so he has decided that explains your situation because it is a convenient solution. She taps an ornate wooden box. This is what my brother likes to do with inconvenient and inconsequential problems. Box them up and shove them aside so that he may focus on the meaningful ones. His maid seems different. That is odd, but she is still filling his coffee cup and cleaning his house, so it is of no matter. She suddenly knows how to read and write. Also odd, but she can take notes now, and that is quite useful. Once, when we were children, I thought to play a delightful trick on him. Each day, I'd move something in his room at night. I planned to blame ghosts. Except my brother didn't mention the moved objects until I pulled his dresser into the middle of the room, and he banged into it in the night. While he had noticed items had moved, until they inconvenienced him, he presumed some logical cause and carried on. Hugh joked that even if Duncan had discovered it was ghosts,
he would only have processed the information and carried on, so long as they did not cause him any trouble.
I say nothing. I know where this is going, and I'm not rushing it along. I'm too busy thinking of a way out of it.
My brother believes brain trauma is the answer, and so he has neatly boxed that up and moved on. He sees no harm in our maid having a new personality, not if it is a far more pleasant one. But I see harm, Katrina, because I see deceit. You are up to something. I wanted to give you the benefit of the doubt, and so I consulted with experts, all of whom assured me that what I described is impossible. You hit your head. You did not suffer actual damage to your brain, not the type seen in personality changes. In short, you are lying.
I say nothing. I need to let that accusation sit, to give it room and weight before I reply. When it's had what it needs, I say, slowly,
"Is it possible, ma'am, that if I am deceiving you, my motives are indeed harmless? If my brush with death has made me realize that
the error of your ways, and now you repent and have become a changed person? Like Ebenezer Scrooge after facing his 3 Christmas ghosts?
I know you are mocking me, ma'am, but I do want to do better. And perhaps I would like to forget who I was. I am simply going about it the wrong way, blaming the injury.
That's the truth, then.
That this is the new Katrina Mitchell, not a guise pulled on to please?
I frown at her. She leans back in her chair.
Come now, Katrina. Do you think me that gullible? You were attacked in the grass market, where you ought not to have been. I was on holiday, and you took advantage. You became involved in something that led to a near-fatal attack. When you woke, you feared my brother would send you on your way. If not, surely I would when I returned. Is it possible you had a change of heart? A near-death turning point?
Yes, but you are presenting us with an almost unrecognizable Katrina. One who is well-mannered, yet not fawning. Confident, yet not haughty. Intelligent, hard-working, respectful to Mrs. Wallace, kind to Alice. And instead of your usual disgust at working for an undertaker, you are greatly interested in his studies, even reading a 13th century translated work on it.
I did read that. I am interested.
This is not you, Katrina. Unless you are claiming to be proof of changelings, a human girl who has cast out her fairy doppelganger and reclaimed her rightful place. You have been here long enough to assess what type of young woman we'd most like in our home, and you have called upon your upbringing and education to become her.
That is not the case, ma'am.
No? This is the new Katrina, is it? Not a brain injury, but a transformation? She doesn't give me time to answer, looks me in the eye and says,
"Then return my locket by morning, or you will pack your bags."
Chapter 18. I walked right into that one. Ran into it. Isla had seen through my brain injury story, researched it, and found it wanting. And in my haste to fix that, I trapped myself. There is only one way out of this mess. Get the necklace. Earlier today, I'd asked Simon for the name of Katrina's usual pawnbroker. He didn't know it, but Davina will. She offered me 20 minutes of her time for a sovereign, which seems to be a pound. I'm getting the idea that's a lot of money, but Katrina has it. I can use it to buy information on Katrina's past and get the name of her pawnbroker. Then I'll pray the shop still has the locket and use more of Katrina's ill-gotten gains to buy it back. I'm taking Isla at her word on this. Like her brother, she strikes me as a fair dealer. She says she'll drop the matter if I return her necklace, and I believe she will. That doesn't mean she'll accept that I've turned over a new leaf, but she will allow me the space I need to prove that. When I first arrived, I'd been so sure of what I'd fallen into. I'd assessed at a glance, based on every Victorian-era movie I've ever seen, every book I've ever read. One sweep of my surroundings and I formed a narrative. Bachelor